Good day, and welcome to Conversations with Tina, wherever the mind wanders. I'm Tina Dillman, and I'm presently in Syracuse, New York, which is located in the central part of the state. We're 3 hours east of Buffalo, 2 hours west of Albany, and we're about 5 hours north of New York City. We are on the land that was once occupied by my ancestors, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Specifically, we are on the homelands of the Fire Keepers, the Onondagas, who are my brothers and sisters of the Oneidas. It is here that I am a full-time chaplain at Krause Hospital, which was founded in 1887 by a group of community-minded women from the Syracuse Women's Hospital and Training School for Nurses to focus on the specific healthcare needs of women and children, and it was the only one at that time. Now we provide care for all adults, new mothers, and premature babies with critical health conditions. I am also a chaplain intern at Upstate Hospital, which is where the show is being recorded. We are right now in the chapel of the hospital that is located right off the main lobby. In comparison to Krause, Upstate is a much larger hospital complex. It is the regional Trauma One Center that is run by the state and conveniently located right next to Krause, so I can walk through an enclosed bridge to get from one to the other. It is at Upstate, which is also a teaching hospital, that I am pursuing my second unit of CPE, which stands for Clinical Pastoral Education. And the reason we are all here today is that I'm a full-time Master's of Divinity student at Naropa University, which is located in Boulder, Colorado. It is important to mention that Naropa was the first accredited Buddhist-inspired college in the United States, and I am fortunate to be able to pursue this graduate degree online. Today, I have the privilege and honor to be speaking with two fellow local chaplains with Buddhist backgrounds. We're going to examine what is known as the first turning of the wheel in Buddhism, where it all began some 2,600 years ago. My first guest today is Janet Stemmer. She's a chaplain here at Upstate. Thank you, Janet, for joining me. If you don't mind, I'd like to begin with just a few moments of silent meditation to ground us in the here and now. Welcome. So, Janet, if you don't mind, can we start with a little bit about you? I'm sure the listeners would love to know your background to and from Buddhism and how you found yourself here at Upstate working as a chaplain. I know, and that may be like a big question to start off with, so feel free to share whatever you're comfortable with our audience.
It's a 50-year journey, basically.
Wow.
Which started with Edgar Cayce reading. Grew up Catholic, and someone gave me a book on Edgar Cayce and reincarnation, and that opened a whole different world. And I had to read everything I could find in a local bookstore, like Krishnamurti or Autobiography of a Yogi or that kind of thing. And so when I was about 10 years into that, I woke up one day and said, I'm going to Tibet. So off I went and realized I didn't know much, didn't know a lot. I was over there about 7 months between Nepal and Tibet and India, and it was very beautiful, but at the same time, you know, you read the books and the stories about Tibet, but that Tibet was no longer in existence, sadly. Mm. So when I returned, I wasn't quite sure what to do, and I did a lot of traveling around the country, some, you know, visiting different Tibetan teachings, trying to find answers to my questions, you know, why am I here, right? Who am I? And ended up studying with a Gurdjieff community, which is a not well-known Russian-Armenian teacher who passed in the 40s, but there are groups that are still passing on. It was more mainly an oral tradition. And when I left that, I was found myself in New York City in Tibetan teachings. So I was back into the Tibetan teachings. Spent some time with a Nechung group and took another trip, this time to Dharamsala, and had a beautiful, it was the spring teaching by His Holiness. Mm. And again, finding that I was not knowledgeable enough, you know, it's very deep teaching in many ways. But when I came back, I ended up studied for a while with Sufis in New York City again, and went back to, I skipped A Course in Miracles. A Course in Miracles is a, and yet it's very Buddhist in a way, you know. I've given everything I see all the meaning it has to me. Things are not as we see, and the appearances are not real. Mm-hmm. And now I am, about the last 5 years, I have been studying with a Advaita Vedanta teacher named Muji, who, that lineage comes out of India, but I wouldn't call it Hinduism. Mm. He was also raised Christian and then discovered this teaching in India. But he's English speaking, which I appreciate, not having to translate. And I find it much simpler. It's just call it non-dualism, you know, is in terms of a simple thing. And it doesn't have four of these and eight of those and three of these.
All the lists.
But,
yeah.
But, you know, so it is mainly just there's no next. Just drop everything and be the sky.
And be the sky.
You know, the rest is all clouds. Coming, they come, they go, they're impermanent, they don't stay. Which is really, you know, our three, the poisons that, you know, in right view of thinking that, you know, things are not permanent. You know, it was a thing in Tibet that they had the sky burials because the body is not important. Once you die, they chop it up and gave it to the buzzards.
Oh, to the vultures.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're... they lived, that was, you know, the most beautiful thing is to be with them because they just lived their teaching. But I, you know, I didn't know enough at the time, but we sat in the courtyards often with them and praying with them and prostrating at the Jokhang Temple and going through the Potala Palace and, you know, when I was there in Lhasa. I love the Tibetan people, and it's almost that was even as much a driving force as their practice.
Yeah. What was it about them culturally that, like, really spoke to you or you found really inspiring? Their kindness or...
The quality... There's no facade. I had a friend, he said, I always get headaches when I'm in crowds because people have all this stuff going on, and I don't have any headaches when I'm walking around with the Tibetans. There was a quietness, heartfulness, compassion. When we were traveling, they would, you know, come over and make sure that we, you know, at night, we had to stay overnight at a bus stop, and they come over and make sure you're tucked in and that you have what you need, and the generosity of spirit. I mean, it's really quite beautiful. Yeah, they're just in kindness, yeah.
Yeah, it didn't matter who you were. They hadn't met you, complete strangers, but yet they acted with the full heart.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, that's so beautiful.
Yeah, just essential, you know, nothing extra.
They weren't looking to get something, a monetary exchange. Yeah, no agenda. Yeah,
just beautiful.
That sounds beautiful.
Simplicity. Again, I think maybe simplicity is my attraction, you know, even with my current teaching, the simplicity.
Yeah, just part of the core foundation. Thank you for sharing that. And so how did you find yourself into the work of chaplaincy? Because you're an assistant chaplain here.
Yes. Yeah. I've been here since 2017, so that's 8 years.
Wow.
After being in New York City, I moved up back to Utica, which is my hometown, to take care of my parents and took care of them for about 10 years. And then was reading online looking for an interfaith ceremony that I had experienced with my Sufi teacher in New York, which was an interfaith ceremony. Nobody had ever heard of an interfaith ceremony. And as I was looking, I came across Interfaith Seminary. And she was on the advisory board, Sheikha Fariha. And so I just thought, wow, this is, they teach all the religions. And I'm still looking, you know, for the answer. And so in all the, I don't care what tradition, they all have truths. So I went to seminary for 2 years. It's a 2-year program, not accredited, like your MDiv. But it was wonderful because it did explore all the traditions, made new friends, and one friend was Reverend Jaina, who decided she wanted, her focus was to be a chaplain, and so she said, "I'm taking this chaplaincy thing at Syracuse," and I was like, "Oh, So I signed up. I could try that. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciated it. I really enjoyed it. Our supervisor, Reverend Terry, is wonderful. And I just found it was something I wanted to continue doing. And so I haven't left. I took 2 units and just continue. I'm retired my day job was a CPA. Mm-hmm. Worked for a lot of not-for-profits. You know, this is, here we go, right livelihood. I always worked for not-for-profits because they did some good in the world. That was always my focus. And of course, met beautiful people along the way in doing that. And I did a little bit when I moved to Syracuse, but I discovered finally it's not no longer right livelihood because I was doing people's taxes, and I found greed. You know, we're talking about the three poisons, a lot of greed, and I just said, okay, I can't do that anymore, so now I'm just doing this 1 day a week, so, mm-hmm. and just enjoying family the rest of the time, mm-hmm. in quiet time, a lot of quiet time, bit of a hermit.
Yeah, it feels like that your life has kind of come full circle in a sense, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Yeah, that balance of quiet time and putting yourself out there and being around others, right? Because especially in our line of work as chaplains, it takes a lot out of us to be able to show up with that empathy and the compassion that we need, right? Well, Upstate is so fortunate to have you here, and I'm fortunate to have met you here, so thank you. So you started kind of talking about these elements of Buddhism, mm-hmm. with the three poisons and, talking a little bit about the Eightfold Path. And then it's like the four like noble truths, which are kind of the big parts of like the first turning of the wheel. But in like your words, like to kind of just backwards to go forwards, how would you describe like if what you recall from like your teachings and learnings of that first wheel turning, like what, how would you describe that action, like of the Buddha and I guess like that moment?
What are you talking about? That was my response in the beginning. What? I can't get it because I was trying to get it with the mind.
And so you don't feel like you really kind of absorbed the truth of the matter because you were trying to make something else from it.
Yeah.
And when you say at the time, we're now referring back like 50 years.
In the beginning, because you know you could tell they had it. They understood it. They got it, but I couldn't get it from them.
From the Tibetans.
You know, all of them, all the teachers and the Tibetans as well. You know, that's, that was, and so it was very frustrating. And then as I traveled, especially over in the Himalayas, you know, you're, it's just very pure whatever, and had some experiences, and nobody could really explain it to me, and so I was looking for my answers.
And going back to your answers, because I think that that's something that's like at the core of like all of our paths, right? Like we're looking for these like existential answers, right? And whose view or process, you know, that we can kind of align with. And, you know, a part of the Buddhist teaching, I mean, his main like beginning was, you know, you need evidence, right? Like you need to experience it yourself, right? Like the Buddha is teachings. He's, you know, very much about, you know, nothing. You should not believe in anything by blind faith, is how I understand it, right? He's like, you have to experience it for yourself in order to make, you know, a sound response and acceptance and understanding
it's
of it.
Beyond mind, so how can mind figure it out? That's my, where I would be now, I'd say. I have to let go of the words. Krishnamurti always said, the word is not the thing. And I didn't know what that meant. And now it makes more sense to me because... I was suffering. As there's, you know, first noble truth, suffering because what? Because you're ignorant. You'd have no idea of what reality is. And you know, something can be new. The reality I grew up with was not it. So I was looking for someone to explain it to me, but it was. And in the process, obviously I grew in my learning and my understanding, you know, right view. Taking care of my parents for 10 years was a lot of right action, right, a lot of compassion, patience, developing a lot of skills in that regard, which of course carried into the chaplaincy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and taking care of senior persons in their home. And I couldn't have done that before I had done everything else. You know, all those other teachings softened me, shall
mm-hmm.
we say,
mm-hmm.
you know, more heartful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they awakened you in
mm-hmm.
a sense,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, caring for others.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I first came back, there would be this automatic response, and I go, no, it's not about me.
Mm.
You know, walk slower, take them to dinner, do what they need to do. It's not about me.
Mm. Right, and that's something in chaplaincy that we talk about all the time, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
Because we have to remember that we have to sort of remove ourselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even when they ask us questions and want to engage with us, we have to turn it around the mirror, right,
mm-hmm.
and have it face them, right?
Yeah.
Which can be difficult for people,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Depending on their faith traditions and backgrounds, they may not have looked at themselves that deeply, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
it can be really painful and scary to do that.
Yeah. You have to meet them where they are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So if I sit through a half-hour conversation with a patient explaining the flat earth theory, that's fine. That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing. You know? Doesn't, whatever, you know, whatever they need to talk about. And the patient, you know, he said, I want to talk, but I don't want to talk about him, pointing to the sky. Yeah, so you want to be able to just, it's okay, whatever it is. You walk in that room not knowing, and you allow it to be whatever it is. And I, you know, couldn't have done it without all of this growth or this journey.
Yeah. Well, this background knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's really interesting how you've, as you've mentioned, you've grown over the years, right? But it's through all of these teachings, but it's the path
mm-hmm.
that you're on, right?
Yeah.
That's never ending at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know where the journey is going to take you.
Mm-hmm.
And you just wake up and face every day as it comes to you. And it sounds like you're still searching. Like, do you still have questions that you're searching for answers? I'm just curious because you...
I feel like I have a little more inner work to do, but mm-hmm. I know what it is, and it's not so much a mystery anymore, shall we say. It's all good. You know, I'm at peace with where I am.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's always more meditation that can be done, more quiet time. And more sharing, I guess, or caring for others, all of the above.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you know, to touch on like the point of meditation, which, you know, as a practicing Buddhist, it's one of the main components, right? It's sort of like thinking about chaplaincy. It's like, you know, action, reflection, action, right? And
mm-hmm.
and meditation is almost an action and a reflection. It's kind of like a two-in-one, I feel like, you know, because when you're sitting in meditation and, you know, your mind wanders and the things that can kind of come up in like those really like deep moments of silence, right, that you're sitting with yourself. And I think we were touching on that earlier where when we're showing the mirror to patients, having one sit with themselves in that quiet moment can be really scary, right? Because we don't know what part of our past or present may come up, right? And sort of like wave at us and be like, hi, I'm here.
Yes.
You want to talk about it, you know?
Yeah.
That can be really scary. But can you elaborate a little bit like in about like your meditation practice and I don't know, like how you've benefited from it or what it looks like for you? Because I just know that everyone has like a, you know, a different way that they kind of go about it in their life. So,
it is just quiet to drop thinking, and thoughts never stop, but you stop logging in, as Muji calls these. Just don't log in. The thoughts go by like the clouds, and the sky isn't going, oh, what about this cloud over here or that cloud over there? You just let them pass and be. So that's, And some days I can do that, and some days, as you know, as a practitioner, some days it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So I would like that to be more constant in my life.
The act of meditation?
Yeah, to be there all the time, more.
Mm.
Even when I'm in life, as we say, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that can always be improved. Because it's always the mind saying, it can be improved, it can be better. Stop looking into that. But, to let that go. But to do that, and I have ways, in the Gurdjieff community, there were sacred dances. And so those movements are really beautiful and very helpful in stilling the inner self. I also learned turning dervish, whirling dervish, which is also powerful in bringing you home.
Mm. Grounding you.
Mm-hmm. Just quieting, letting the rest go.
Mm.
Yeah, just brings the stillness.
Mm.
So just, you know, various things. And of course, reading and satsang, listening to Bhuji and satsang. We do that. I have a group that we meet once a week and enjoy his latest in there. He has a good media team putting out new satsangs all the time. And so we watch those. I was there with him on his land, his ashram in Portugal in September. And basically everything was go find a place and be quiet.
Mm. That was the essence of the
retreat.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So and that's the focus is at this time, is for the quiet.
Mm. So what does that environment look like for you? Like, what works for you in terms of how do you get to that place where you can be quiet with your mind?
In terms physically or?
Well, just like, you know, metaphysically, you know, like, I love sitting underneath trees or, you know, being outdoors, or maybe, you know, some people prefer to be inside when they're meditating.
I live alone, so it's, I have some beautiful space in the house. Mm-hmm. To do that, that I enjoy. That's probably the primary.
It's indoors
for
you?
And I have an outdoor. I'm always singing to Tara in my pool. She has this connection to water, I don't, for me. And I will do chanting to her whenever I'm near water, whatever that is.
Mm.
Even doing dishes. White Tara. Just letting it be, you know, sometimes it just arises, you know, and sometimes I'll wake up in the morning and I'll be doing a Sufi chant. I don't know, things arise, you know, and that's kind of like me and the universe conversing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, through these different methods.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, just let it be and just say, oh, yeah, good. I just... I'm not alone. I'm never alone. You know, I just feel that connectedness to all that is.
Mm.
You know, one of my favorite books now is Ashtavakra Gita, and he says, "I am the seer of all things. I am the single witness of all things."
Mm. And we are all interconnected, right?
Yes, yes. There is no... I mean, I had the experience one time of hugging someone, and then I was them hugging me, and then I was me hugging them. So I know it's not so fixed.
Mm. Yeah, it's not... I like to tell people, I'm like, we don't live in, like, the black or white. Like, we're somewhere in the gray.
You know, in the quantum physics now, they are also having that... They are seeing that. That this is not so physical.
Mm, that our what we perceive as reality isn't what we necessarily perceive it as,
right? Yeah, yeah.
And I think the Buddha was getting to that as well in his teaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? There's the quantum activist, and I'm not sure, I can't, Dr. Amit Desai or something like that, said that he grew up having to read all the Hindu teachings, and then he became a physicist, and then he had to go back and read the teachings again because he saw the similarities.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of that, you know, like that weird coincidences of of different, you know, philosophical beliefs and how they relate to science, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that there are, we don't have time to go into it right now, but, you know, there's, especially with Buddhism as well.
Yes. All, you know, that Buddhism came out of the Hindu tradition, out of India, so.
Yeah, because people were searching for answers, right? Mm-hmm. So, well, unfortunately, we have to wrap up. I would like to just sort of ask, like, to kind of circle back to, like, this notion of the Eightfold Path, which we were talking about, and the role as a chaplain. And, you know, is there, like, one sort of message that you could leave, you know, the audience with in terms of something that you've learned that has really helped you in terms of your practice as a chaplain from your study of Buddhism that you feel, you know, that, you know, would be a good message to sort of leave those that are listening to us?
Right speech. Right listening. Mm. No, that's the same. Do no harm, which is the abbreviated version of being in compassion. Listening, speaking.
Mm. Those are probably the two most important of the Eightfold Path with the role of chaplaincy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, those are huge, right? With the no harm, which is a foundation of Buddhism as well, and also the bioethics of working in you know, healthcare. So it's really important. Yeah. Oh, and how do we achieve that, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, so much there. Well, thank you so much, Janet, for your time today and for coming in and chatting with me about this. We are going to take a quick break. And when we return to Conversations with Tina, Wherever the Mind Wanders, we'll continue this conversation about the first turning with our next guest, Rob Bundy. Thanks for tuning in today to Conversations with Tina, Wherever the Mind Wanders. My next guest today is Rob Bundy, a retired Buddhist chaplain. Welcome.
Thank you.
I thought to begin, we could just take a moment of silence to kind of ground ourselves in this moment.
Beautiful.
Okay, wonderful. Welcome. Rob, can we begin our time today with you talking a little bit about your background, how you came into Buddhism, this, you know, your pathway also into chaplaincy?
Sure.
Sharing with us? Okay.
Yeah, happy to. And you had emailed me that you were going to ask me this question, so I had been thinking about it. I think I have been a spiritually oriented person since childhood. And it really came into fullness in junior high school. And that's when I found Christianity and at a very intense way. Mm-hmm. A group of friends in junior high school, we would go to these evangelical churches, and I was saved by Jesus, and I became quite a devout Christian, and that continued throughout my high school, and it wasn't settling enough. There was something missing, and I couldn't quite figure out what that was. Mm-hmm. Then I think where I began to be more interested in the Eastern religions is in my undergraduate years, I fell in love with a woman who had just come back from India to have her baby, mm-hmm. and she was a very devoted Hindu slash Buddhist, and which is not an uncommon combination. I came to discover, and suddenly I found myself sort of immersed in this different world and different way of looking at spirituality that really clicked for me. And she introduced me to the Ramayana, and I read a lot about Hinduism, and then she also introduced me to the early concepts of Buddhism, and so that's where it all sort of shifted for me. The big shift, what I would consider the tectonic shift for me, was when I was 50, just before I turned 50. Mm-hmm. My midlife crisis was, what I'm doing as a professional theater director, which is what my career was, just isn't enough. It just, I woke up one morning going, this isn't enough. This is, I don't want to continue my life like this. This just feels way too hollow and way too burdensome. And so I called my dear friend, said, what do I do? She goes, you should go sit somewhere. So I went to the Insight Meditation Society and did a series of meditations. One was a 3-month long meditation. So I really jumped into the that practice. And that was a significant shift for me. So at age 50 is when I began to understand what it takes to be a committed, devout Buddhist. And I started that practice. And I then looked for places to go. And because I wanted a teacher or a mentor. And because I'm kind of a cheapskate, I found this one Buddhist temple that didn't charge you for coming to stay with them. It's called a Metta Forest Monastery. It's in the hills outside of San Diego, so it's just east of San Diego.
Okay,
and it's it follows the Thai forest tradition, which is very, very stark. Very, very simple. And it was in a beautiful location. It was an avocado grove. And so in the avocado grove, there are these plywood platforms. And you set up your tent there, and you walk about a mile up to the temple, and you sit with the monks. And then you help during the day, but then you also meditate. And the abbot there, his name is Tanisaro Bhikkhu, Jeffrey de Graaff is his Western name, is one of the foremost writers of Theravadan Buddhism. I found his writing really compelling, very simple, and very easy to understand and sort of immerse myself in. And so I found myself gravitated towards Theravada Buddhism, which is the early, early Buddhist practice. The Theravadins,
Hang on one second.
Sure.
So sorry about that.
No, that was me. My alarm went off by mistake. So we'll just take it from Theravada.
Okay. So the Theravada Buddhism is the earlier of all Buddhist practices, and it only follows what's called the Pali canon, and Pali is the ancient language that they believe that the Buddha spoke, and so it's the Pali canon. So what it doesn't do, and the way I describe it is, we are the Orthodox Jews of Buddhism. We are very, very precise, and what we don't do is allow cultural influences to change the way we interpret the words of Buddha. And that changed, you know, with the Tibetan Buddhism, all kinds of other practices and religious practices from Tibet began to, they color that Buddhism. It's a beautiful practice. I have nothing against it. Mm-hmm. But I was really interested and more comfortable with just the simple teachings of the Buddha. Mm. And so that's how that all sort of began. And at age 50, when I had my tectonic shift, I thought, okay, so what do I do? You know, if I'm going to leave the theater, which is everything that I trained for and prepared for it since high school, what do I do? And I talked to a good friend. He said, well, you have performing arts background, so why don't you look into drama therapy? And so I looked into that, and as I'm scrolling around, I found this whole thing on chaplaincy and never even thought about it. Sort of dismissed it, thinking, well, I don't know. I mean, chaplain. I don't even know what that is, and I wouldn't know how to begin to train. And then, as destiny has it, another email, I have no idea how it came into my box, but it was from the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care, which is a training program for Zen Buddhists to become chaplains. And I thought, well, there's an introductory weekend, you know, where you go and they tell you what that it's all about. I went there, and it was like I had come home. It was really a wonderful feeling. And, you know, there's part of me going, well, I'm Theravadin. I'm not Zen, you know. How's this going to work? It worked just fine. And so I trained for 2 years with the New York Zen Center and then moved up here to Syracuse because my partner at the time, now my spouse, was offered the chairmanship of the Syracuse University Drama Department. And so we picked up and moved. I was delighted to find out that Upstate Hospital has a CPE training program. And so I did 2 more years with Reverend Terry Culbertson. Now, let me explain, because everyone goes, oh, so you've had 4 years of chaplain training. The very first year with the New York Zen Center is considered what they call the foundation year. So it's not officially CPE. So I've had 3 years of CPE training.
Three units,
yeah. Exactly. And then I did it just because I loved what I was learning about myself and about my spirituality and how to be, to talk to people and how to listen and how to undo some of the things that I had thought was the only way to operate in my mind as a theater director, which is to fix, you know? And so I just loved doing that, never imagining that a Mexican gay Buddhist would ever be hired up here in upstate New York, you know? But lo and behold, the head of the Krauss Hospital Spiritual Care Department, Reverend Kate Day, who I had studied with in CPE, I ran into her. Again, one of those crazy things of where I'm not looking for it. I'm with some friends up in a town called Skaneateles, and I round the corner, and there's Reverend Day, and she goes, call me on Monday. I think I have a job for you.
Wow.
And so I called her, and then for 5 years, I was on the staff, the spiritual care staff, as a chaplain, and in heaven. I was getting to follow, from the Buddhist point of view, right livelihood. Which is how to contribute and not harm, and ideally not leave a footprint behind, which is one of the things that the Buddha encourages. You know, so there's no legacy. There's no, you know, with a theater, you know, there's a legacy requirement. You want to have a body of work. You want to be identified. You want to be remembered. And with Buddhism, you want the exact opposite. You want to make your impression and then disappear. So I was in heaven. It was terrific, even though it was very rough, because I was also there during the COVID epidemic, which was extremely difficult, but deeply, deeply gratifying. So I've talked too much.
No, not at all. Not at all. You've jumped upon like a few things that I'm like, oh, let's go back and talk about that a little bit more. Because the program at the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care is like the only one that I'm aware of that exists in the country in terms of like the Buddhist practice for chaplaincy.
I think you're right.
Yeah. And you studied with Koshin and Chodo.
Yeah.
I just read an article by Chodo in a book that I got. How was that? Because you, just to talk a little bit about, you know, they're Zen focused, yet you're coming with the Theravadan, you know, background and interest. How did that work for you? Like, were there like similarities in the Zen mind frame and your mind frame, and how did they coexist?
That's a great question. There were similarities because the baseline is Buddhism, and the baseline is the Buddha's teachings begin with the Four Noble Truths, and then the precepts, and the Eightfold Path, and so all of those were the same. The approach was a little bit different, and it made perfect sense for me that it was the Zen practice that would be training chaplains, because part of my understanding of Zen Buddhism is that it challenges the individual and is happy to reach in and shake you up and see where you land. And so I was really challenged, really pushed. For instance, I'll give a great example. My very first year, towards the end of it, I had an interview, you know, a talk with Chodo and Koshin. And they said, you know, everybody just thinks you are the friendliest, nicest person. That all of your classmates just think you're the best and so buoyant and ebullient. And we know differently. You're very angry, aren't you? And I felt stripped naked. And they were right. And so that kind of reaching in and changing and challenging and then sitting back and saying, so land. Are you going to land on your feet? Are you going to land on your butt? And then what are you going to do? You know, it was fantastic. Because it allowed me to push through myself into a deeper self. So I actually really liked that Zen practice for that. Not enough to change my practice, because I liked the Theravadan, and they were very respectful of that. You know, because there's a couple differences.
Yeah, will you elaborate on that?
Well, one of the major differences is that the Zen practice encourages you to become what's called a bodhisattva, which is that you commit to reaching as close to enlightenment as you can, but don't go to the other side until all humanity is ready to join you. So you endeavor to help everybody until we are all ready to enlighten. And I didn't like that at all.
You didn't want to wait.
I didn't want to wait, and that's not at all what Theravadan is about. Theravadan is get to your arahant, get to your next step, and when you're ready, enter the stream and go. There's no requirement for you to wait. And the other thing that was a big difference with the Zen is that there's this, you are taught that there is an inner Buddha just waiting to wake up inside of you, that it's all here. It's all inside you. And Theravada doesn't agree with that at all. Theravadan says, the Buddha never said that. They never said that there's an inner Buddha. How you reach enlightenment is to develop the skill set and learn to meditate and follow the Eightfold Path. And it's a prescribed journey. And once you achieve that skill, you are ready to enter the stream and seek enlightenment. But it's not like something magical wakes up inside of you that's always been there. So I liked that, because then it didn't feel like there was something wrong with me that the Buddha was sleeping. It's a skill that I need to learn and develop and perfect.
Yeah. So thinking about like the first turning, right, of the wheel.
Right.
Which falls like right in line with the Theravada, and it's like the essential, this is the beginning.
Right.
Yeah. And so in the Theravada beliefs, so mm-hmm. how would you describe that like first turning of the wheel for like the Buddha? Like I've heard the stories, you know, I'm just sort of curious.
Sure.
Yeah, how you would describe that and the essentials of like what that first teaching, and some say his last teaching, the first and last Dharma, you know, talk of that he gave.
Yeah.
And explain that for a little bit for those that may not know what that means, right, at the beginners.
Sure. So the story of the Buddha was that he was born into enormous wealth. Mm-hmm. He was part of the Brahmin class in the Hindu hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And his father protected him and kept him within the compounds of the mansion. And so he never saw anything bad, mm-hmm. you know, and he had all the pleasures he could ever want. And so to him, by his father's encouragement and nurturing, thought that the world was just perfect and beautiful. And then there was one day where he went outside and saw a beggar, a sick person, and a corpse. Mm-hmm. And went, wait a minute, that's not the world I understand. And that really shook him up. And he said, there's something else, which I really get, you know, because mm-hmm. that was for my tectonic shift. There's mm-hmm. something else that's got to be going on here, and I need to go and find it. Mm-hmm. And so he practiced for many years a series of different kinds of spiritual practices. Mm-hmm. And his last set of colleagues, mm-hmm. he said, I'll be right back. I'm feeling something here. I'm going to go and just sequester myself for a little bit. And so he mm-hmm. went and he sat underneath this tree called the Bodhi tree mm-hmm. and said, I'm not moving until I get it. And this took a series of lifetimes to get to that point. And he admits that. He said, but then he said, you don't have to have a series of lifetimes to get to this point. If you actually understand what's going on here. And so in his enlightenment, he understood what's going on here. So that first turning of the wheel was his saying, this is what I've come up with. And that is the Four Noble Truths. Mm-hmm. So the people that he lectured, his very first Dharma talk, mm-hmm. was those colleagues that he had been practicing with before, who mm-hmm. thought that he had really turned on him, mm-hmm. on them. You know, I mean, they were, you know. But anyway, he convinced them and said, these are the Four Noble Truths. And so that's how it all started. And then he said, based on these Four Noble Truths, there is now a path that you can follow. And that path consists of these various things. And it's not like, you know, it's the eight precepts. And it's not the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. There's nobody in charge. That's one of the Pali chants, mm-hmm. is there's no one in charge. So you are the master of your own destiny. You are the master of your own karma. And mm-hmm. so follow these paths. Nobody's judging you, but you mm-hmm. will develop this karmic energy that mm-hmm. will take you to where you want to go, which mm-hmm. is ceasing to re-enter what's called the rebirth cycle, mm-hmm. because that's part of the suffering.
The samsara.
Samsara, exactly, mm-hmm. where you continue to rebirth because you don't know what else to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and so the idea, and the Tibetans are very good at describing this, the idea is that when you have reached enlightenment and then you die, you don't panic and run into the nearest incarnation that's coming your way. Mm-hmm. You actually keep going towards the light. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that you disappear into nothingness. And mm-hmm. that is the liberation. Mm-hmm. That is so different from my early Christian point of view of you do the right thing, you get rewarded, and you go to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And for the Buddhism, the ultimate heaven is nothingness.
Mm-hmm.
It is quiet stillness. And that is the point of meditation, is how do you get in touch with and practice simply being still and being in the present tense? Because one of the other things that the Buddha said, at least my understanding, is the portal into paradise, which is nirvana, which is literally meaning quenching the fuel of the fire.
Mm.
So if you don't have the fuel of the fire ceases to exist. And the fire feeds on suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you let it go, you cease to exist. But the point is that, oh, I've forgotten what my point is. Uh-oh, hope we'll have to edit that. I did, I just lost it.
That train of thought, see, wherever the mind wanders.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, no, you were talking about nirvana, right? And reaching into that nothingness versus your pathway before as being a Christian.
Right.
And the variation of the two.
Right.
And the goal of Buddhism to be the, you know, essentially the cessation of dukkha, right?
Right. And dukkha is suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, this is, yeah. So, yep, it hasn't come back to me. So sorry.
No, it's okay. That's how these things go.
And at 2:30 this morning, I'll go, right, this is what I was saying.
Oh, that one point.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's okay. We don't need to edit it in. It's just, it's lost, and maybe it'll come up in like the next few minutes.
Yeah.
So, but I appreciate all of that. And you were touching upon some things that are really important of this, like the first turning.
Mm-hmm.
One essential that we haven't touched upon yet that I'd like to speak a little bit about are the three root poisons.
Right.
Yeah. So do you mind just, I guess, sharing your perspective of those? Because they're kind of essential. I mean, they're what caused the suffering to begin with for all humankind.
Right. Which is clinging. Wanting to hold on to what you think you need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course, the image that always comes to my mind is the monkey who dies with a fistful of peanuts. Have you ever heard that analogy?
No.
There's a narrow neck jar,
mm-hmm.
and there are a bunch of peanuts in the bottom of that jar, and the monkey reaches down, and he can't pull his hand out because he won't let go of those peanuts, and he starves to death. And that's grasping. That's clinging.
Yeah.
So that and disdain or anger is my understanding of that's the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one, which is the toughest one for me to wrap my head around, is delusion, where we don't even know what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that ignorance is what is preventing us from actually solidifying. And so those are the three that you have to let go of. One is disdain and anger at yourself first, others after, and then any kind of clinging. And boy, that's tough. You know, and the Buddha even talked about it. One of the hard things for him were the of relinquishing pleasure. Just the sensual pleasure. And when you say sensual pleasure, you're going, oh boy, just sex. No, it was about enjoying food to the point that you're a glutton, that you eat, that you overeat, or that you won't eat this because you like that better. And so there's that process of clinging and disliking other things or disliking other people.
Mm-hmm.
If you have hatred towards another person, you have misinterpreted where you are in the universe because we're all together.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you dislike somebody intensely, you've created an us-them scenario that is false.
Mm-hmm.
We're all together. So then, and this is part of the thing that I loved about the chaplaincy training, was this patient has pushed my button. Who do they remind me of?
Mm.
Do they remind me of myself?
Mm-hmm.
Where is my compassion for that person?
Mm.
Instead of judging them, and mm-hmm. saying they're closed-minded, they're angry, they're impossible to get through. What's the hurt underneath? Mm-hmm. And how can I identify with that in terms of compassion? Mm-hmm. And so by doing that, you release the anger because it has no place. Mm-hmm. But again, the very last one, delusion, you know, where I think I know what I'm talking about, but I may not, you know, and so how to wake up out of delusion is a big one.
Yeah, well, it's good for you to acknowledge, you know, like where your weaknesses, right, are.
Yes.
And so that way it allows one to be able to spend more time, right? I mean, that's kind of just for anyone's problems, right?
Yes.
Like the biggest thing, the hurdle to get over is to be able to acknowledge that you have that issue.
Yes.
Right? Because as soon as you acknowledge it and you make it present in the room, then you can start to see where it comes up in your life, right?
Right.
And
yeah.
then you're able to tackle it and work at it, right?
Perfect. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Well
yeah.
said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the point that you made about the being angry, right?
Yes.
And not having compassion for others. Just real quick, there was this, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh is now passed, and hopefully he's, you know, up in, you know.
Or gone.
Gone, right, yes, empty.
Yeah.
Or just all around, you know,
yeah.
empty. But he had this really valuable teaching about, like, hungry ghosts.
Yes.
Right? And that really resonated with me because it allowed me to see, you know, how I could have been angry towards another person in my family that hurt me,
mm-hmm.
right? And in that exercise of meditation, you flip, right? And you put that person who's hurt you into that seat where you're then like, oh, like putting them like as a 5-year-old, I think is what it was.
Mm.
And so when you look at them as a 5-year-old, then you're starting to able to develop compassion for them
yes.
because you're seeing them at the vulnerable state of who they are, right?
Yes.
And because we're all interconnected, if you have hate or anger or whatever against someone, that's really having that against yourself.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep, exactly right.
And that's not healthy. And that's not a good way to live.
It's not a good way to
no,
live.
No, no, not at all.
Yeah.
And in terms of us like bringing this into the chaplaincy role.
Yes.
The Eightfold Path. Right?
Right.
Like, that is the prescription that the Buddha gave. Like, okay, these are the problems. This is the root of it. Now, how do you go out there and achieve it?
Right.
Right? And he outlined it very simply.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the Eightfold Path is broken into sort of three categories of meditation, wisdom, and what's the other one? Oh, ethics.
Mm-hmm.
Out of that Eightfold Path and in your role as a chaplain, what do you think was the most important elements of that Eightfold Path that you maybe utilized or thought about in your work as a chaplain? And, you know, wisdom is the right view, right intention. Ethics is the right speech and right action and right livelihood that you talked about earlier. And then meditation is the right effort, right mindfulness, and the right concentration.
Mm-hmm.
Is there one that really resonates you in that role as a chaplain or
yeah.
multiple maybe?
Yeah, you know what? I think I would probably say right ethics, how to be present and listen and how to be meditating as you are in an encounter with a patient. Favorite memory of mine was Thich Nhat Hanh was being interviewed by Oprah Winfrey. And she goes, so how often do you meditate? And he said, I'm meditating now. And that was a perfect answer.
Mm.
And because if you are present with that other person with openness and compassion and listening to them, that's how you can serve.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's that one to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so powerful. Just that image of him saying that to her and then her mind being blown by the answer.
Totally.
Right?
She just sort of blinked and went, oh, okay. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And unless you understand the act of meditation, right? And like really like what these simple words mean, I mean, they are very simple. And I think, you know, maybe I'm speaking because I know, but putting them into practice is just, I feel like it's very simple. Like, yes, the only thing that's holding you back is yourself.
Yes.
Right? Like,
yes,
we can be our own Achilles, yes, heel.
Very much so.
You know?
Which is what that CPE training is so wonderful about. Mm-hmm. You know, and yeah, very much.
Yeah. Yeah. The class, some of my classmates will eventually take CPE, and I'm just sort of trying to give them as much resources and sort of information and get them prepared, because right, it's really life-changing.
It is.
The clinical pastoral education, as you kind of mentioned earlier, what that did for you, it, mm-hmm, you know, it turns your world upside down,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
It gets you to really kind of see things through another perspective that you had never even imagined was possible,
yeah,
and really allows you to go deep into that closet of yours that you're like, you know, had packed your early childhood trauma,
right,
you know, and you thought it was safe and secure, and then all of a sudden CPE, you're like, hey, what's in this box up here,
mm-hmm,
you know, and then you open it and, you know, it's Pandora's box, but it's a beautiful Pandora's box,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, because the possibilities of opening it and walking through that, you know, doorway, the threshold, you know, and is just beautiful.
Yeah.
The possibilities are endless,
yeah,
you,
yeah,
know?
Yeah. And it's arduous. It's hard to do. Yeah.
It's very,
yeah,
hard work.
Yeah.
Very,
yeah,
hard work. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just to sort of like wrap up our time here, I went by so quickly. What would be, like, in terms of like last words,
mm-hmm,
as a practicing Theravadan, you know, Buddhist, and working in chaplaincy, I don't know, are there like words of wisdom that you would give to listeners that are like, you know, maybe thinking about going into chaplaincy, or that are starting their Masters of Divinity, mm-hmm, and, or exploring Buddhism? Is there some words of wisdom or,
sure,
insight that you would provide for them?
Yeah, two words: be present.
Mm.
I think, and that was what I was actually trying to allude to and I forgot, was the whole idea is to be present in the present moment, because that is the portal into what is,
mm,
and what is the universe. And you can't do it when you're thinking about regrets or making plans. So, mm, to be present. And one of the great teachings that I got from Chodo and Koshin is, every time before you walk into a patient's room, put your hand on the threshold, on the door jamb, and just be aware of your feet,
mm-hmm,
be aware of your body, be present, so then you can walk into the room greeting that world as it is, not what you think it should be or what it was in the next room.
Mm-hmm.
And so be present is what I would say.
Mm. I love that.
Yeah.
I love that very much. It's the essence of Buddhism, right? And to live a happy, fulfilled life,
yeah,
is just to be present in every moment.
Exactly.
Oh,
yeah.
I love that. Oh, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Oh. My pleasure.
And in wrapping up, I just, you know, want to thank everyone who's listening, and to also thank Amelia Hall, my instructor of the First Turning class that brought us all together today, and for the man behind the scenes, Tom Zaradnik, for providing his producing and engineering skills in helping me, you know, produce my first podcast here. And for all of those tuning in, I would just like to say, please remember, for one to truly love thyself, you must be gentle, kind, and compassionate with yourself. Especially in times like now, where our world seems to be on fire and raging with anger and hatred, we must be that bright light that shines on others during these moments of distress. Be the light and shine with love. Thank you for your time and dedication in listening today. Take care and be well.